So I'm Bill Blatt. I'm with the American Lung Association National Office, and I'm here to talk to you about our CTG project, which is expanding smoke-free communities. Smoke-free communities was our first project under the federal community health funding. It was part of communities putting prevention to work. But rather than telling you a lot about ALA, well, first of all, I have nothing to disclose, and CDC makes no claims over what I'm saying today. But I don't want to tell you about ALA. I want to tell you about the environment we're working in with this project. You know, we've heard a lot about 50 years of progress since 1964, and we have done amazing things, and I know there's a newer number coming out, I think, next week, about that 19.3%. But the reality is not everyone has benefited from this progress. I'm going to flash through these numbers really quick, but if you look, you know, certain racial and ethnic groups smoke at much higher rates, use tobacco at much higher rates, still, 50 years later. We know when you look at education, people who are more educated tend to use tobacco less. People who make more money tend to use tobacco less. I mean, clearly, this is an uneven playing field that we're dealing with. We know there are other groups. There are people with mental illness, LGBT people, people who live in rural areas. These are all groups that are disproportionately impacted by tobacco use in our society. And so that's where we wanted to put our attention. When you look at secondhand smoke exposure, we are seeing non-Hispanic blacks have the highest rates of secondhand smoke exposure at work. This is based on cotinine levels. These are all slides I pulled from a training we did for our CTG awardees last December. And I wanted to put them in here just to say this is the environment which we saw the project existing in, where we wanted to try and make a difference. And again, secondhand smoke exposure is highest among these groups. So there's a lot of work out there to be done. So expanding smoke-free communities, we received $800,000 a year for 3 years. I tried to do a strike-through. I had 5 years and tried to do a strike-through because that's what we thought was going to happen, but it was 3 years. And our subrecipients were all selected from our network of local American Lung Association offices across the country. You saw the five potential focus areas at the beginning. We focused specifically on tobacco-free living. What we did was we issued an RFP to our local lung associations, and we said, tell us what you want to do. We ended up funding two cohorts. There was the first cohort, 16 months long. We took a little longer to get started than we thought, so it was 16 months instead of 12. And they received $120,000 per project. And then we had a second cohort that was 12 months long, as planned, and that was five projects that received $80,000 per project. So when we issued that RFP, we had some requirements. First of all, the CDC requirements. Our target populations had to be under 500,000 people. That has to do with all those different CDC, you know, CTG awardees that people had. We absolutely could not duplicate or overlap other federal community health funding. That's a trick because, boy, is there a lot of community health funding out there, particularly with CTG. And so it was a little tricky finding areas, you know, which CDC wasn't already working in some way, but we did find them. And then from the ALA, we said we would strongly prefer projects that addressed tobacco-related disparities. And we said that folks must use evidence-based tobacco control strategies. And we actually provided a list of about 12 strategies in the back of the RFP, and we said, choose one of these 12 or choose another evidence-based strategy and prove to us that it's appropriate for your population and that it's evidence-based. Every proposal we received focused on a population that was disproportionately impacted by tobacco use. Our local lung association stepped up on this one, and they really did a fantastic job reaching out to community partners, finding a local organization to partner with, and really involving the community, which was the whole idea of the project. So again, all of our projects, as a result, did address tobacco-related disparities. In particular, we worked in rural communities. We worked with low SES populations, low socioeconomic status. We worked with Native American populations. We worked with populations of people dealing with mental illness. One of the requirements in the project was that each local project had to have a community leadership team. And so we at the national office thought we should do the same thing. So we had a national community leadership team. And so we pulled together folks from our local lung association offices, from our national board, just some dedicated volunteers, and asked them kind of how the project should be set up. And we followed their recommendations. This was the chairman of our board at that time. He attended, and he said, you know, he heard about the first cohort of projects, and we talked about what we would do in the second cohort of projects. And he said, wow, this is really where the rubber's meeting the road about health equity at the Lung Association. And we said, yeah, it is. I mean, this is a really fantastic thing we were able to do. And so we use this quote everywhere, and we say it's from the board chair all the time. It's a big thing for us. So folks did all kinds of different things as a result of the way we set up this project. And so I wanted to kind of highlight a few of the projects, three of the projects specifically, that I think they're diverse, and I think they accomplished some great things. And so I want to talk about them. The first one was in the southwest part of Virginia. That is not West Virginia. This is the southwest corner of Virginia where the state gets kind of pointy. This is Appalachia. This is tobacco-growing country. This is a very poor part of our country, and these are folks, you know, who've been there for generations. You know, the way of life there is deeply ingrained, and these are folks who have used tobacco for generations, who have died from tobacco use for generations, who have made their living from tobacco use for generations. And so the project here was to create tobacco-free school environments, and that includes all school property, so inside, outside, you know, the field they have down the street, all school vehicles, all school events, everything happening both on and off campus. And you may be saying, schools already are tobacco-free. No, they're not, particularly in this part of Virginia. They all have tobacco-free policies in place. They have to. It's a federal thing. But, you know, the practical sense is when you're at the football game, you know, on Friday night, which a lot of folks are, people next to them are smoking, and you're really breathing in their secondhand smoke. And the kids are seeing that person smoking, and they're modeling that behavior for those kids. And so this is really an area that needs work. And so our staff member down there, who is one of those people you can just never say no to, she was an absolute firebrand. That's Billy. You know Billy. She worked with school districts and superintendents and students and convinced them, and school nurses, they were great, and convinced them of the need to adopt a comprehensive tobacco-free policy. These are voluntary policies. And to enforce it, to have signage, to talk to people who are using tobacco on school property, and to really make sure that you are actually having a tobacco-free environment for the students. She picked five counties to work with in the first cohort and did such a fantastic job that she picked five more counties nearby in the second cohort, and we funded her again because we wanted to keep a good thing going. So this was the outcome. I'm colorblind. So the counties that are colored in, those now have tobacco-free schools in Southwest Virginia. None of them did before. The stars, those are city school districts. You're either in a city or a county in Virginia. Those are city school districts that adopted this. There's more than the actual number of target communities because some of the nearby counties, like Grayson County, you see down in the center, they heard about what was going on nearby, and they said, we want to do that. You know, can we get some signs? Can we adopt this? How are you doing it? And so it's really kind of continued beyond the initial scope of the project. Publicity is important in this kind of thing. You need to get the kids to buy in. You need to get the schools to buy in. And so one of the things they did was a poster contest with the students, and the two students who won in the two school districts that did it, they actually had billboards donated. And so their drawings were blown up to billboard size, and they were on the highway, and so for, I think it was about 2 or 3 months, that particular billboard was up there promoting the idea of tobacco-free living. It's fantastic. We're so excited. Our staff member there is actually now working for the Virginia School Board Association, consulting and going around Virginia trying to get other school districts to go tobacco-free. And so this is that program sustainability right there. I mean, that's a fantastic thing. So we're so excited to have been able to kind of give a little push at the time it was needed in the right spot in Virginia. If you can do it in this part of Virginia, you can do it anywhere in the country, honestly. You just need the right people, and you need the community buy-in. Another project we did was in the South Bronx in New York. Boy, this is another one that was tricky not to overlap funding because New York City gets a lot of federal funding. But there we found that many residents of multi-unit housing in the South Bronx were being exposed to secondhand smoke, not because people were smoking in their unit, but because people were smoking in the unit next door or below them or above them. And secondhand smoke travels a lot. The idea there was to convince buildings to voluntarily adopt smoke-free policies that would cover the entire building, preferably the entire property if they have property outside the building. And so the initial plan was to, you know, work with tons of different buildings and go one at a time and work smoke-free, and that just didn't really work. So what they ended up doing was working with two major landlords who each owned a bunch, they were companies, who each owned a bunch of buildings in the South Bronx. So one of the landlords, for example, owned 7,000 apartments in the South Bronx. And they were willing to go smoke-free, but they needed someone to kind of get that little push, to walk them through, to say, okay, let's do some announcements for the residents, maybe hold a forum, we'll provide signage, you know, and let's kind of just keep going. Don't stop, you know, don't forget about us, we're still here. And so that's what they did. They also had, this was the only slide CDC made me change when they reviewed it. And what I originally said here was diverse leadership team with heavy political involvement. What I meant was heavy politician involvement. That probably doesn't help. But what happened was when we said, you know, form your local community leadership team, the borough president's office sent someone. They wanted to be part of this. The city council representative sent someone. They wanted to be part of this. So there was fantastic representation from all different parts of the community. Residents sent someone. You know, they wanted to be part of this too. We found one of the landlords we worked with worked in what I call crisis care housing. So these are women who are, primarily women, who are escaping abusive relationships. These are patients with HIV who need a safe place to live, things like that. So those are some of the buildings. They are absolutely some of the most in need parts of our society. And so it worked. Those buildings that they live in are now tobacco-free. They're no longer being exposed to secondhand smoke. And so we were so excited there to be able to work with a population that, that really needs it. There are 187,000 residents of multi-unit housing in the South Bronx. We like to think we, again, have kind of started a wave there and that more and more buildings are going tobacco-free, and we have seen some evidence of that. This was a promotional piece that ALA of the Northeast, which covers that South Bronx, put together. They put together a series of postcards to mail to property managers and property owners in the South Bronx to kind of remind them about the importance of going tobacco-free, and that it's not just about the health of your residents, although that's our primary interest, but it's also that, you know, tobacco smoke costs them a lot of money as a property owner. And so here's one of the examples about turning over apartments and you know, fire danger and things like that. So, so again, it was a really interesting project. It's one that is continuing through the various organizations in New York that are carrying on the work, including the ALA of the Northeast. The third one I wanted to talk to you about is our Northern Michigan project. This is from our second cohort, and here the idea was we see some of the highest tobacco use rates in the country among people with mental illness, and we see very few culturally appropriate cessation services available. We see that the mental health system, you know, in many places hasn't really tackled tobacco. They just, you know, they've kind of been left behind by the mainstream tobacco control organizations. And they're dealing with a lot of other issues, and so it just kind of hasn't been necessarily on the top of the list. That's starting to change, and this project is one of the ways that we're starting to change that. So there, the community partner was the Northern Lakes Community Mental Health System. They provide community-based mental health for about, I want to say, 8 counties around the Traverse City, Michigan area. So that's kind of like, my husband's from Michigan, so I can do that. It's like this part of Michigan up here. And they have 5 facilities. And they had no particular tobacco policy. You couldn't smoke indoors, but they had no kind of particular policies, and they weren't really addressing tobacco use with their population. The CEO was on board, like, from, you know, the CEO of Northern Lakes was on board from the beginning, so we were like, hey, we'll be done by, like, January, you know, this will be easy. No. It took a lot of community forums, again, with the staff, talking to them about what was coming up, why it was important to do this, tons of staff training. We also provided cessation services to the staff. Because there is, you know, with this population, a lot of times if the staff goes outside, you know, staff person goes outside to have a cigarette, a patient may go outside to have a cigarette too, or client. And it's sort of there's an aspirational relationship in a lot of times. These are peer leaders, many of them. And so we thought it was important for the staff to have the ability to quit tobacco use if they wanted to, and many of them did. A couple of graphics here. So these are the signs that we made. Providing signage is such a great sort of plus to get people to do what you want in this area. So you'll see we put these up. September 15th, 2014 was the start date for the tobacco-free policy across all of Northern Lakes' 5 facilities. They worked extensively with not only their partners but their neighbors. So the main office is in Traverse City, and next door is the Traverse City Transit Center, where the buses kind of all stay. And they knew that if their clientele couldn't smoke on property, they would walk next door have their cigarette. And that's not okay. And so they talked to the transit center, and they said, would you be interested in going tobacco-free? Yes, they would. So both facilities went tobacco-free on the same day. And so they had, you'll see on this sign, you know, the Northern Lakes logo is on the left. They put the transit center's logo on the right for the signs that were on the property line. So it was a joint effort. The same thing in, where was it? I've been to a lot of places in Michigan. One of the small towns in Michigan. Their facility shares a parking lot with the local health department, the county health department. Would you be interested in going tobacco-free? Yes, they would. Same thing. And so it was a joint effort, September 15th, 2014. Both facilities went tobacco-free. We got to walk around, and I walked around the parking lot and said, I think a sign should be here, you know, and so we plotted all that out. It was a lot of fun. We've started talking about this project a lot because there just aren't that many interventions aimed at the mental health population. People are fascinated by this one. It's like, wow. We had someone from OSH heard a presentation in Ohio and came up afterwards and said, this is cutting edge. We're like, well, no, it's not. It's doing what we should have been doing all along. But it's just a group that hasn't been receiving services they need to receive. It's actually a card. The 2 sides of a card that you see on the right there. These were like business card size, and these were made to go around and hand out to anyone who was using tobacco on Northern Lakes property or the property next door, to kind of gently say, you know, hey, we changed our policy. Can't do that here anymore. But also on the back, you know, here's some services to help you quit if you're ready to quit. People get very nervous about when you start a policy like this, you're going to have kind of like riots in the streets the day it starts. Almost none. People were super receptive. They knew it was coming. They knew the date. We framed September 15th as a celebratory date, and it came across that way. This is a great thing to move, you know, public health forward and to advance the health of everyone who works and is served by these organizations, and so we're really excited by that. These are all the projects I don't have time to talk about today, but these were the other projects we did. We did a total of 5 out of our 11 projects were smoke-free multi-unit housing. Within the constraints of the federal funding and all that stuff, that's a really it's an easy one to work on because these are voluntary policies. But if you look at some of the populations we served, low-income, senior, disabled, in New Mexico, it was public housing authorities and tribal housing, which, tribal housing is not tobacco-free there. And so that's a big switch, and we had to talk about, cultural issues versus commercial tobacco. We also worked in Maine, and that was, you could smoke inside the tribal health department in these communities in Maine. Inside the tribal health department. That's not okay. And so they haven't made as, timing's different when you're working with Indian communities. So they're still working on it in some places, but they have made a lot of progress towards having tobacco-free buildings and events. Columbia, South Carolina, we worked with Free Clinic. And so this is the lowest SES part of the population. These are folks who are homeless, who have, no health insurance, no transportation, a lot of times no job. And so we said, are you talking to your patients about tobacco use? Nope. Do you have services available? Nope. And so they partnered with the Free Clinic to begin doing that. It's been tough getting that started, but it is started now, and so we're very excited that this population is being served. We educated folks on the benefits of smoke-free workplaces in Mesquite, Nevada. That includes casinos. Not a lot of smoke-free casinos in Nevada. There's none, actually. This would have been the first. They still don't have smoke-free casinos in Nevada. But folks have been educated, and so we're hoping that at some point, Mesquite will be the first smoke-free gaming community in the state. I've mentioned sustainability a couple times. First of all, when you make these kinds of policy changes, that's small P policy, don't worry, they're sustained. I mean, once the policy is changed, it does not tend to be changed back. And so in that case, all the strategies that have been implemented in the successful projects we had, they're still in effect. In many cases, the work itself is ongoing. The multi-unit housing work in Maricopa County has been now funded by the state. They're seeking additional funding in Michigan. I mean, there's all kinds of stuff that continues to happen. The new relationships that were built between the local lung association and their community partner, the main community partner and all the other community partners, those are flourishing. And it's fantastic to see people continue to work together. And then finally, the tools, the success stories, the resources that we've developed and that they developed as part of their local projects, those are all still available too. And so, the project itself ended a couple years sooner than we expected, but it really was a fantastic effort, and we're very excited about what we were able to start and what is being sustained in this present day. I don't have my contact information up here, but if you call 1-800-LUNG-USA, you can always reach the American Lung Association, so I will stop there.